to 6 o'clock about that as well. We'll keep you up to date with everything that's happening in Lebanon. As I said earlier, changing by the minute. We'll be getting more reaction to that as well, and hearing a full interview between Chris Mason and the Prime Minister as well. That's about 20 past six. But first, let's get your BBC News headlines at 6 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
The headlines then on Drive at 6 o'clock. Israel's military has suggested its extensive bombardment against Hezbollah in Lebanon is in preparation for a possible ground incursion into the country. Lebanese health officials say more than 50 people have been killed and hundreds injured in Israeli strikes today. In the past hour, Keir Starmer addressed the UN Security Council in New York.
We need an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Lebanese Hezbollah, and the implementation of a political plan which allows Israeli and Lebanese civilians to live in peace and security. That security will come through diplomacy, not escalation. There is no military solution here, nor is there a military-only solution to the conflict in Gaza.
Well, earlier, President Zelensky told the UN General Assembly that Ukraine would never accept a peace deal imposed on it by other countries, and he questioned the motives of China and Brazil in pushing talks with Russia. Mr. Zelensky also said he'd received alarming intelligence that Moscow was planning attacks on Ukrainian nuclear power plants.
If, God forbid, Russia causes a nuclear disaster at one of our nuclear power plants, radiation will not respect state borders, and unfortunately various nations could feel the devastating effects.
Delegates at the Labour Party conference have voted in favour of a motion from the Union Unite calling for the government to reverse its cut to the winter fuel allowance. The conference vote is non-binding. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth has more.
Throughout the conference, ministers have been asked about this, they've addressed it head on, and there is certainly no sign that they're budging, but that vote does send an important signal to government about the mood of this party conference. A very clear message that they don't agree with that position on the winter fuel cut.
Figures from the RAC show that the average cost for a litre of petrol has fallen to a three-year low. Last Friday, the typical price at UK forecourts was 135.7 pence. The RAC attributes this to a fall in oil prices and a relatively strong pound. Crimes including shoplifting and fraud cost the Co-op Group almost £40 million in the first half of this year. That's an increase of 19% on last. And as you've heard on Drive, Alan Bates, the man who led the campaign to help post office staff who were wrongly convicted in the Horizon IT scandal, has officially received his knighthood. He was awarded the title in the King's Birthday Honours for services to justice. Those are the news headlines then. Shoujo's got the sports news.
The Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag has added his voice to the concerns over the increased fixture schedule. United start their Europa League campaign at home against Twente this evening. It's another European club competition which has been expanded this season. Ten Hag says there are too many games and too many competitions in football, with players facing almost unavoidable risk of injury. AFC Wimbledon say they've not been able to secure an alternative venue to host their League Two fixture against Accrington on Saturday, and as a result the match will have to be postponed. Wimbledon's ground was flooded this week and the pitch is currently unplayable. And Australia's netballers sealed victory in their three-test series against England as they won the decider 69-56 in Victoria. The England captain, Fran Williams, says it is disappointing they couldn't back up such a strong performance in Sydney, where they had levelled the series at 1-1.
In latest travel news, on the roads in Cheshire, the M6 northbound, two lanes are closed between junction 16 at Stoke-on-Trent and 17. There's been an accident there and you're looking at pretty severe delays. It's looking slow back to junction 15 currently. The West Midlands, the M42 southbound, two lanes are closed between junction 5 at Solihull and junction 4. There's a vehicle fire happening there that's been dealt with at the moment, but it is causing queuing traffic. The M1 around Bedfordshire, this is northbound. There was a broken down vehicle around junction 11 at Dunstable South. That's now been moved, but it is looking very slow. You're looking at delays of about 25 minutes because of that. And in Devon, the M5 is partially blocked. This is at junction 30 at the Exeter turning. It's happened on the roundabout, so expect delays. Ellie Brennan, Five Live Travel.
This week on Five Live and Five Sports Extra.
Tomorrow, there's ball-by-ball commentary from the County Championship on Five Sports Extra.
Cold, and that is that.
And tonight at 8, we'll have updates from the Europa League and live commentary as Liverpool face West Ham in the EFL Cup.
Five back in!
Five Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
Tony and Holly with you on Drive. Now, the Israeli army chief, Herzi Halevi, said the latest strikes on Lebanon to prepare for the possible entry of troops. The Israeli military says it's been carrying out extensive strikes in the south of the country and the Bekaa area. Lebanon's health ministry says at least 53 people have been killed in today's attacks and more than 220 have been injured. Many people in southern Lebanon are fleeing north. These women left their homes to take shelter in a school in Beirut.
My son carried me. There were airstrikes where we lived. Everybody had left. There was nobody there. We were the last people to leave. The kids were screaming. They were scared, and I was scared too. I hope everything calms down. I hope there's a solution. May God help the people of the south.
Well, in total, the UN says more than 200,000 people have been displaced in Lebanon since October last year. 90,000 of those have left their homes in the past 3 days. Eva Homsey is an aid worker for The Shield, a humanitarian non-governmental organisation. She's in southern Lebanon, 5 miles from the border, and she spoke to Five Live earlier.
We can say there is 3 main points: the fear and the anxiety, the isolation and the uncertainty. No suppliers are reaching the area because of the airstrikes on the roads. But at the same time, people are not able to move. Since 2 days ago, there was a huge displacement from all the south. There was a traffic. Till today, there is people still on the road because they don't have any place to reach. They are sleeping in the parking, outside the roads, without any blankets or mattresses. So Marjayoun area, there is still remaining population. At the same time, displaced people from the border villages. And the situation is really hard. They are afraid from not being able to receive any assistance from now till 1 week. There is no bread now. We are trying as a local association to support with bringing bread, water, hygiene needs. There is no medication. Even if there is in one pharmacy that still exists there, they have no money to buy the medication, and no medical associations or organizations are present there because of the access.
Meanwhile, Israel says it intercepted a ballistic missile earlier today that was fired by Hezbollah towards Tel Aviv. Daniel Mensah is an Israeli government spokesperson.
This is the first time in history that Hezbollah terrorists have fired at the city of Tel Aviv. Thank God the missile was successfully intercepted by IDF's David Sling aerial defense system. Immediately following the missile attack, the launcher in southern Lebanon was struck and destroyed.
Well, joining us now is Dr. Patrick Bury, who's a former NATO analyst and defence expert at the University of Bath. Patrick, hi to you. Welcome to the programme.
Hi, Tony.
We mentioned military chief, Herzi Halevi, earlier on, saying that there could be a possible incursion. He went on, I'm reading a dispatch from Daniel De Simone, who's our reporter in Jerusalem, and he says he went on to say that to tell soldiers their military boots will enter enemy territory and destroy them. Do you think it's inevitable now Israel will go in on the ground?
It's not inevitable. Nothing is, but it's increasingly likely, I think, Tony. You'd see it as a sort of phase one is the air preparation and the bombardment, and also the information operation to get as many civilians out of there as possible. And then phase two, given the threat that Hezbollah have posed, not only from the rockets launching sites in southern Lebanon, but but also from the from their raids that they can do using some of their Radwan forces. I think it's increasingly likely that you're going to see some sort of ground movement by the Israelis through there. The question is, what's their overall intent? Clearly, they're going to want to push Hezbollah back and clear the areas like they've been doing in Gaza. But do they want to stay? Is it going to be more like a raid and a withdrawal, etc.? So we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, but that is the key question, isn't it? Because they say they want to get those 60,000 residents back into the north, but just a temporary occupation of southern Lebanon would do that in the short term. But then if they withdrew, they would create another threat. So what was it? They've offered to destroy. They want to destroy Hamas, don't they? What do they want to do to Hezbollah, do you think?
I think, reduce them as much as possible. I mean, if you're looking at this from the Israeli perspective, they're on a roll, Tony. They've looked for a ceasefire in Gaza and has not been forthcoming on terms they're willing to accept. So they've basically pummeled Hamas into the ground, destroyed huge swathes of Gaza doing it. And now their attention has switched to the other threat on the north, which has actually been the long-term looming threat for Israel for years. Iran has thrown a huge amount of missiles at them, and with their partners, Israel has been able to fend them off, and then successfully with one missile take out the most important or most advanced air defense system that Iran has. So that's a real big shot across the bows. Everyone in the region realized that, okay, right, the Iranians aren't as strong as they appear in this regard. And then they killed the leader of Hamas in Tehran. Again, not a good look for the Iranians. And then they had the successful walkie-talkie and pager operation last week, which is a major, major failure for Hezbollah. And now they immediately back that up with an air bombardment, which has started destroying the site. So the Israelis are thinking, I'm pretty sure, look, we're on a roll. Although a lot of people in the West in the region are trying to de-escalate and hold us back, no one is actually going to pull the rug in terms of military aid to us and really looking at the US before an election. And therefore, we may as well keep going and do what we can to, in their perspective, secure their neighbourhood, as it were.
Yeah, but you still can't help but circle back to the original point, though, that for example, as a show of strength, impressive maybe, but in 2006, that there was a conflict there with Hezbollah, that, which was inconclusive. So they presumably have a final war aim, and that can't conceivably, can it be a permanent occupation of southern Lebanon?
I don't know, to be honest with you, Tony. Like, if you look at what they've done, if it is basically dismantle as much as possible in the near border area, Hezbollah's ability to launch rocket and infantry attacks on the settlers, sorry, on the residents on the other side, well, then that will be delineated by geography, and they may create basically a clear zone. You know, if you look at the way they're telling all the civilians in that area to move, and so many of them are. It we'll just have to wait and see what exactly their war aims are. Like, I take in your point exactly. Like, it doesn't make much sense just mowing the grass, going in there, getting rid of them for a while and coming back, and then letting them spring up again. So if you think through it logically, you're thinking, right, there's going to be some sort of cleared and secured zone, at least covered by fire, if not actually by boots on the ground.
In the short term, we've already had the Prime Minister here advise British citizens to get out by any means possible, and more troops sent to Cyprus, possible military evacuation. What's your instinct there, Patrick? How do you see that panning out?
Yeah, well, I actually used to be in the brigade that's most likely to be targeted with that, which is a high readiness 16-hour assault. Obviously, they've been, one of the key things is the intel gathering and being cognizant of the understand piece about what's going on the ground. And the British have actually positioned stuff in Cyprus for a good few months. They're just increasing the footprint there now. Of course, while people can be evacuated commercially, and as the Prime Minister said, you know, get them out commercially, but I think there's only one airliner doing still operating out of Beirut. So I suppose the next be prepared to is to launch some sort of military evacuation operation. We've seen them done successfully in Sudan and also successfully under seriously difficult conditions from Kabul. Hopefully it doesn't end up like the latter. But essentially, yeah, they'll be cooperating with their partners, cross-government effort, and then trying to use probably the embassy and get the message out to eligible residents to where they need to go to muster, probably for initially, if they can, an extraction by air. If not, the backup would be by sea.
Patrick, always good to talk to you. Thanks for your time on the programme.
Cheers, Tony.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Patrick Bury there, former NATO analyst, defence expert at the University of Bath. We're doing more on this story now, but also Johnny Ironson, I'll let you know, is in for Gordon tonight on 5 Live. And so any further developments as the evening goes along, Johnny will bring you those from 10:30.
Yeah, interesting hearing Dr. Patrick Bury there talking about what happens to those UK nationals, given the advice from the UK government is to leave Lebanon immediately. A lot of people struggling with that, however, due to a lack of flights. We know that the Ministry of Defence is sending 700 troops to nearby Cyprus to prepare for a possible evacuation. Now, I spoke to Dan Harper, who is a journalist who lives in Beirut with his family. He is among those struggling to get on board a flight. I spoke to him just before we came on air today.
since the situation deteriorated, there was a clamour for flights, and everybody, you know, that could got a ticket and either has left or it will be leaving. I mean, there are Middle East Airline flights, which is the national carrier, but we can't get on any. And now we're waiting to see if we can be evacuated. And I think that they'll only do that if it deteriorates further, which is, you know, by that time we'd like to be out.
Yeah, but what does that look like in terms of the situation deteriorating further? They're already urging people to leave right now and you're waiting for an evacuation at this point.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, we should have left earlier, but they've been telling us to leave since last October. And if you keep hearing the same rhetoric, and, you know, you've got your lives here as we have and children in school, it's very difficult to just, you know, leave for an unknown amount of time because we've been living here many years. So we decided to stay, and we can now hear the sounds of the distant, you know, missiles landing and things. And it is a little scary, especially for the children. We do have a plan to maybe move further north up the country towards Junye, where perhaps it'll be a little safer. And then if needed, you know, and they do evacuate via sea, we'll be closer to the port as well, where they would hopefully take us by ship, as they did in 2006, to Cyprus.
Dan, do you mind me asking, how old are your children?
My daughter is 9, my son's 11.
How are you explaining this to a 9 and 11-year-old right now?
He's a bit more aware of what's going on than she is because, you know, he's been at school earlier this week and they were talking about it and showing pictures and things. And he looks at the newspaper and I want him to be aware a bit of what's going on. And he's, you know, but not to the point where he feels too scared. And I've said, you know, we are far away from it. It is in the south in the country. They've always had these skirmishes between them. It's just a bit bigger than it was, you know, and the second that it becomes dangerous, we'll leave this area. But where we live, there's never been anything that's happened, but being close to it, you know, the closer it gets, the more scary it gets.
Yeah, and I appreciate, you know, you're trying to be strong for your children, but I mean, how do you feel right now? Are you concerned that it has become dangerous?
I'm trying not to panic, but at the same time, I do feel now a certain anxiety to go when possible, and I really wish the messaging was a bit more clear and up to date. You know, Keir Starmer keeps saying, you know, I urge you to leave now. All British nationals left there. Well, there's a lot of us, you know, the more than they expect because not everybody's registered, you know, that have lives here. Lebanon's a very multicultural country. I used to be on the radio here for many years and the main radio station was in English. You know, it gives you an idea of how multicultural people here are and how welcoming to foreigners they've always been. And I've been very comfortable here for many years. So I can imagine there's more people like me that are a bit worried about how they're going to get out, especially when they hear, you have to leave now, you have to leave now. Well, it's not that easy. There are no flights available for us to get onto. And I'm not going to go and buy a boat and start, you know, learning how to sail to Cyprus. I'm relying on the government to come and get us. And we'd just like to know when that will be.
Yeah,
and hopefully not too late.
What's the communication been like? I understand the British Embassy is still operating out of Beirut. Have you spoken to anybody? Do you feel they have control of the situation?
You can't get through to them. You get put through to a switchboard in London and they say we have nothing definitive to tell you yet, but just be ready, you know. So I'm also worried about my wife because she's Lebanese and, you know, will she be able to get on board the boat with us? You know, something I'd like to know. They shouldn't have this in place already. They should be telling us, yes, she'll be accepted. She's the mother of two British nationals. She's got a visa. No problem, but they can't even answer that question, you know. Pretty worrying for us not having answers that we need.
Yeah, we did hear from him earlier on the programme, Dan, and it's just a horrible situation to be in for those thousands who are trapped over in Lebanon at the minute. Again, the advice from the UK government being to leave Lebanon immediately, so we wait to find out what happens next in that situation. It is 18 minutes past six.
Yeah, if you were listening to Drive a little bit earlier, you'll have heard that we took the speech by Sir Keir Starmer at the UN Security Council in New York live. He addressed the situation in Gaza, in Lebanon and Ukraine as well. Before he gave that speech, he sat down with the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason. So we're going to play you a couple of clips from that now. First of all, the Prime Minister was asked by Chris about the situation in Lebanon.
So what is your message to British citizens in Lebanon?
Leave now. It's very important. The situation is escalating. We need the situation to de-escalate. But I say to British nationals, Don't wait. Leave now. We are ramping up the contingency plans for an evacuation, as you would expect. But my message is, don't wait for that. There are commercial flights still coming out. It is important to leave, and to leave now. And through you, I really want to get that message across to those individuals in Lebanon, because it's very important that I do it.
You're deploying hundreds of troops to nearby Cyprus. Would you put troops into danger on the ground to help evacuate Britons if that becomes necessary?
I am not going to get into the details of evacuation plans. As you would expect, we put contingency measures in place. But here in New York, in the UN General Assembly, I'm being very, very clear. This is a dangerous situation now, and all parties need to pull back from the brink to de-escalate. We need a ceasefire, and this needs to be sorted out by diplomatic means. Very, very clear messaging on that, very firm messaging on that, along with key allies. But I am very concerned about the increasing escalation, which is not just day on day, but almost hour on hour at the moment.
That is Sir Keir Starmer speaking to our political editor, Chris Mason. Well, after that interlude, Chris then turned to domestic issues, and he asked the Prime Minister about one of his key phrases in yesterday's speech to the Labour conference.
I want to unpack one of the phrases that you use repeatedly and have done for a few months: country first, party second. All the doom and gloom that we've heard from you guys in the last few months, that was talking the country down, wasn't it? That wasn't country first.
I think if we're going to have to take difficult decisions, and we are, it's important that we do the diagnosis. What's the state of the country? What's the state of the economy? And the two or three things I'd say that dominate are the £22 billion black hole, the Lord Darzi report into the NHS, which effectively said it was on its knees, and, of course, the terrible state of our prisons. Now, you have to get the diagnosis right, because then you've got to go on and say, right, it's our responsibility to fix it.
Could you be making it worse? So Andy Haldane, formerly of the Bank of England, talking about creating a fear and foreboding, uncertainty for business and consumers because of the language that you've chosen to use.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that anybody seriously would argue that the NHS is going gangbusters. It's never been in better shape. If we were
to say
that,
I don't think anyone's saying the NHS is going gangbusters. But another example, I mean, the BBC is reporting today about growing unease within the NHS about that language talking about it as being broken. That might put off patients seeking help.
Well, I say broken but not beaten. I do understand from the staff perspective, it's really hard. When the Labour Party, when we last had a Labour government, confidence and satisfaction in NHS was at an all-time high. Imagine how you felt working in the NHS then. Because of what the last government has done, it's now at an all-time low. That's really difficult. I mean, my wife works in the NHS, so I get a daily dose of this.
Does it give you pause for thought, though, in the round, that the language that you might have used, the net result of that sounds incredibly negative? It talks the country down.
No, that's not right. We have to have an accurate diagnosis of what the problem is, and then our job is to say, what are we going to do about it? Short-term difficult decisions, but what I was setting out yesterday is, as it were, the purpose behind it, and trying to answer that question, which is important: what do we get for it? And making it clear that the purpose of the difficult decisions is to make sure we grow the economy, living standards, everyone better off, our public services back properly functioning, an NHS that's on its feet, fit for the future, we can be proud of, and taking the necessary measures on border security and national security. That's what you get for it, but you won't get there if you don't do the difficult things first. And that was my main messaging yesterday.
And how soon could we get there? Give us some sense of this, the time frame from the improvements that you talk about. Are we talking about a year, 2 years, 3 years?
Well, one of the things I was really pleased to be able to do yesterday was set out the things that have already begun to change.
Sure, but so, what about the other stuff?
Well, don't underestimate setting up the National Wealth Fund for investment to come in, GB Energy, so that we can make the transition to clean energy.
Sure, and we were able to yesterday.
The Border Security Command has been set up, the commander is...
Sure,
I'm
interested in this. Central to your argument is the tough stuff now for the prospect of a brighter future. It's that timescale on the brighter future.
Yes.
So that people can come to a judgment as to whether or not it's worth it.
Well, some of the things we're fixing very quickly. So, Homes for Heroes, for example. Heroes, you know, veterans who are on the street without a roof over their head. We're already moving to fix that, along with care leavers, along with those subjected to domestic violence. On issues like the economy, I'm not going to sit here and pretend to you that by Christmas we'll have turned it around. It will take time. The most important thing in growing the economy is to get the investment in that we need. Almost every investor I've spoken to, and I said, well, why aren't you investing in the UK? Because actually, with our universities, our skills, our innovation, our science, our leading sectors, we're a good place to invest. They said to me time and time again, because of the instability under the last government. Mm-hmm. That's why we've put stability number one. That will be the trigger. Now, what I want is that investment to come in as quickly as possible. And I'm hoping we'll see some of that reasonably quickly to turn the economy around.
That is the Prime Minister then speaking to the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason. They were both in New York. So, subsequent to that, Keir Starmer addressed the UN Security Council, and later on he will speak to the General Assembly. Say, Johnny Anson's here from, I think, 10:30 tonight. I'm just going to quickly scoot back in my running order here to check. Yep, 10:30. So any developments there, Johnny, will bring you those here on 5 Live, 6:25 now.
It's Holly and Tony here with you for the next 35 minutes. And, you know, this week we've talked about camels. We've also had some Aman on today talking about surviving being attacked by a hippo, things I did not think I was going to be talking about today. Aman, well, I shouldn't say a man, he's a specialist, he knows what he's doing. He's adopted a toad that he found in a supermarket bag of salad. Yeah, wow. I don't know much more than that. A toad in a bag of lettuce. That's all we need to know.
Well,
that's
it. Was it rocket? Was it watercress?
These are the questions that we need to find out.
They're endless. I once found a toad under my wheelie bin. It made me jump about 6 feet in the air. They're massive. It would have done some damage in that bag of salad. On that subject, we've been talking about being attacked by a hippo. And I said earlier on, well, your interactions with hippos, I didn't think we'd get any. Mary in Chester says, my friend Emma was trodden on by a hippo. When she was in Africa, it ran over the tent that she was sleeping in. She still has a dent in her leg to this day. They are a dangerous beast. But I'm not laughing at that. I'm just laughing. I don't know what I'm laughing at.
Well, it's just quite bizarre. We really didn't expect to get other hippo-related
surviving hippo. That was a brush with death if a hippo runs over your tent. I was once camping and a sheep ran over a friend's tent, but it pales.
Well, that
pales into insignificance.
Those were the sort of stories I was expecting today. You know, there's someone who's texted him who's been chased by a hedgehog.
Don't say we're going to ask Dad what's run over your tent.
No.
We could be here all night.
But I do want to hear from people who've been chased by hedgehogs.
Well,
I know someone who was chased by a badger once. Okay. I mean, these are standard things.
There's always tomorrow. No, there's tomorrow to fill yet, Holly. Don't throw everything out there.
I got attacked by a penguin once. I haven't even mentioned that.
Oh, we'll do that. We'll do that tomorrow.
Yeah.
Did it run over your tent?
No, it did not.
Save it. Save it.
No.
Right, 6:27. Oh, so we must just say as well, 5 Live Sport on the way at 7. Steve Crossman's here. We've got live footy commentary again for you tonight. Liverpool's match against West Ham in the Carabao Cup, the third round. We'll speak to Michael Brown about that very shortly. But there's all sorts of issues that United are playing in Europe, and Arsenal play Bolton in the Carabao as well. And various other matches going on all over Manchester United, I should say. I get told off for just saying United. There are more than one United. Anyway, all that's to come. It's 6:27.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network.
5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
So yes, what is the weirdest thing that you've ever found in your groceries? I mean, I've once found a spider in my grapes, that's about it really. But a toad, on the other hand, that is what one shopper at a Waitrose in Berkshire found in their salad bag. Now the toad is currently in custody, as it's not clear if it's an alien species or not. Which is quite important actually, because if a foreign species of animal is set free here, it could disrupt the local ecosystem. Here to tell us more is Graham Martin of Berkshire Reptile Rescue, who's looking after this toad. Hello, Graham.
Good evening.
First of all, most importantly, how is the toad doing? Is he or she okay?
I'm just going to call it.
Clever.
Is doing really well. It's been eating. It's been stomping around all day. It's quite happy where it is, I think. So I've decided I'm just going to keep it as a pet, just to sort of rule out any breaching of convention, you know.
You're quite happy with your new toad. They are quite cute. And this is quite a small toad, isn't it? Which is why we don't know whether it is a he or a she.
Yes, it's basically the size of my thumbnail.
Oh, okay.
It's not huge at all. Obviously, a jumbo-sized toad, as big as you can get. I've think somebody would have noticed that packing the salad. So,
here's the thing. Yeah. When I was first thinking about this story and I heard about a toad in a bag of salad, my understanding of toads is they are quite big. I thought, how could that possibly happen? So that makes a bit more sense then.
Yes. Big toads would have moved faster, and this one's probably just got scooped up with the salad as it's being plucked and picked and just launched into the bag and gone through the processing centre and come out the other end not particularly worse for wear.
So the question is, where on earth has this little toad come from?
Well, the trouble is, what normally happens is Joe Public, who finds said whatever animals in their salad or their bananas or whatever, deals with it themselves. So the lady, I think she was a lady, the person in question has sent it back to the shop. The shop sent it up to the depot. The depot's got a little bit confused and rung me up and said, can you look after this and sort this out, because we don't know what we're doing. And which is quite conscientious, really. They could have done all sorts of things with it, but they've done the best thing with it. And they get salad from primarily... quite a lot from England, but primarily Europe. But there is stuff that comes in from all over the world. So it could be from anywhere.
So that's the thing, isn't it? Because we're very lucky in this situation, because a lot of people would have just gone, well, I'll just take it down to the local pond, let he or she run free. Yeah. But that could be quite damaging to the local ecosystem.
It could be. It's not that it's sort of going to breed, because obviously it needs others of its same species. It's more any pathogens, diseases and parasites and such that it could spread to other organisms of like species.
So do toads not interbreed? Are they quite fussy?
Generally, species only breed within their own set bracket. So if it is closely related, the one we think it is closely related to ours. How much genetic problems could we end up with that? So it's not a good idea.
So we don't have a name for our little toad, which is quite difficult. We don't know whether it's, we don't know what sort of toad it is or where they came from. We don't know an awful lot about this toad, but if anyone can come up with a name, I'm sure our listeners can. What have you been calling it?
I'm just calling him Toad currently.
Well, historically, in any of the famous toads I know, they always tend to be called Toad or Toadie, don't they? We're not very imaginative when it comes to naming toads.
I've had several people suggest Mr. Toad, which is very sort of Wind of the Willows-y. Yes. But it's like, well, Mr. Toad, what was Mr. Toad's name? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just called Mr. Toad.
Exactly.
And then somebody suggested Warty McWartface, and I'm like, well, that's just I don't know. That's just a bit mean.
He or she doesn't look like a little wart face, no.
Just because he has warts doesn't define
who the toad is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So look, let's give a bit of advice out to anyone who finds a creature like this in their groceries. I think that's the important message to get across here. What should they do?
Contact a local animal rescue of that type. If it's a spider, then an exotics rescue. There is a number of them throughout the country. You can usually just go on Google and find your local one. We cover Berkshire and a few of the surrounding counties. But people have literally brought things down from Scotland and Devon and whatever back in the day when there weren't so many rescues about. But there seem to be flourishing all over the country at the moment.
So basically, you've got yourself a new pet then, Graham.
Yeah.
Oh.
I've always liked toads. It's sort of where I started keeping exotic animals, because I used to, when I was, I don't know, 10, keep frogs, toads and newts in the shed, and some fish and some whatever, all sorts of weird and wonderful creatures from the woods. And then once you get to a certain age, you can't really do that anymore. So you've got to sort of go and get proper pet animals. And we just ended up with lizards and various species of frogs and stuff. So... it's just an excuse to keep it, isn't it?
That's a very happy ending. Thank you for getting in touch. Graham Martin of Berkshire Reptile Rescue. Hopefully, we will get a name for the toad as well. 85058. It is 6:33. Let's get your news headlines.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Israel's military has warned of a possible ground offensive into Lebanon as it continues its bombardment against Hezbollah. Lebanese health officials say more than 50 people have been killed in Israeli strikes today. Speaking to the UN Security Council earlier, Sir Keir Starmer called for an immediate ceasefire. Rail workers with the RMT union have accepted a pay deal, ending a series of strikes in a long-running dispute. Staff at Network Rail and at train operators agreed to an increase of 4.5% this year. Train company workers will also receive 4.75% for last year. Delegates at the Labour Party conference have voted to reverse the winter fuel cut in England and Wales. The motion, which is non-binding, was put forward by the Unite Union. And the payment systems regulator says UK banks must refund victims of fraud up to £85,000 within 5 days from next month. Most high street banks and payment companies voluntarily compensate customers who are tricked into sending money to scammers. Right, those are the headlines. Show Joe's got the sport.
Well, the holders, Liverpool, welcome West Ham to Anfield this evening in the third round of the EFL Cup. That will be our commentary match here on 5 Live this evening from 8. Calling the game for us will be Conor McNamara.
And tonight will be the first time that Arne Slot will be involved in a knockout game as Liverpool coach. Liverpool, who didn't recruit many new players in the summer, but they've started very well. Just 2 goals conceded in 6 games before tonight. West Ham did recruit heavily, but they've had a disappointing start under Julian Lopetegui. They lost 3-0 at home to Chelsea on Saturday. It means that for the first time in their 129-year history, West Ham have lost their first 3 home league games in a row at the start of a season. We expect Liverpool to make wholesale changes tonight. West Ham probably don't need the distraction of a cup game here, but they do need the confidence of a positive result. Last season, these sides met at the quarterfinal stage, and Liverpool won very comfortably here at Anfield by 5-1.
Thank you, Connor. One other tie in the EFL Cup tonight. It is Arsenal versus League One side Bolton. Chris Coles is at the Emirates Stadium.
For the first meeting of these two in over 12 years, Shojo. Bolton were a Premier League club back then and used to always give Arsenal a decent game with their contrasting style. How competitive will tonight be? That probably depends on team selection. We could see 16-year-old Jack Porter playing goal for Arsenal, with first starts also expected for teenagers Ethan Nwaneri and Miles Lewis-Skelly. Bolton off the back of a good 5-2 win over Reading in League One, but their manager Ian Evatt has already said he'll be rotating. For all of Arsenal's good progress in recent years, the Cups have been a bit disappointing. Failing to make it past round 4 in either the League or FA Cup in the previous 2 seasons, it would be a major surprise though if they were to fall tonight.
Regular updates from Chris Coles throughout the evening from the Emirates. There's a whole bunch of matches in the Europa League tonight as well. Manchester United start their league phase against the Dutch club Twente. Tom Gale is at Old Trafford.
And an extra special night for Erik ten Hag, Shojo, as he welcomes the club he grew up supporting, made over 200 professional appearances for before becoming assistant to Steve McLaren, who together secured Twente's only Dutch league title to date back in 2010. The last European trophy Manchester United lifted was, of course, the Europa League 7 years ago now, and ten Hag's made it clear they're in it to win it. As for Twente, their 8th visit to England in European competition, still yet to taste victory.
Thank you, Tom. Some really exciting cricket news. The England and Wales Cricket Board have announced that Test captain Ben Stokes remains on track to be fit to lead the side on their 3-test tour of Pakistan next month. That wasn't looking so good a few weeks ago. Henry Moran has the details.
Stokes initially injured his left hamstring playing in a 100-match at Old Trafford in August, forcing him to miss the entire Test series against Sri Lanka. The results of scans today have been described as positive, and Stokes remains on track to participate in the upcoming Test series in Pakistan, starting on October 7th. In his absence, England were led by Ollie Pope to a 2-1 series win in that series against Sri Lanka, with Stokes watching on as part of the England group. They've got a busy autumn, the England Test side. 3 tests in Pakistan, followed by 3 more in New Zealand. And they'll be delighted to have their skipper back fit.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed on that one. And in rugby league, centre Zach Eckersley has signed a new 4-year deal with the Wigan Warriors. That is your latest from BBC Sport.
In the latest travel news, on the roads in Cheshire, the M6 northbound, you've still got severe delays and 2 lanes remain closed between junction 16 at Stoke-on-Trent and 17. There's been an accident there. Recovery work is underway at the moment, but congestion is back past junction 15 currently. And the West Midlands, the M42 southbound, 3 lanes are closed between junction 5 at Solihull and junction 4. It was a caravan fire earlier that's causing these delays. Congestion is back to junction 6 with Birmingham Airport, and also slow if you're heading northbound as well. Ellie Brennan, 5 Live Travel.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
Good evening, Holly and Tony here with you on Drive for the next 20 minutes. A lot of you getting in touch with your toad names. I knew you wouldn't let me down. Keep them coming in, 85058. But for now, though, the Payment Systems Regulator has announced that UK banks must refund victims of fraud up to £85,000 and within 5 days. So most high street banks and payment companies voluntarily compensate customers who are tricked into sending money to scammers. But from October the 7th, these refunds will become mandatory. Now, Carol Alexander is a university lecturer in finance and was actually scammed out of nearly £80,000. Here's how Carol felt when she was scammed and what she thinks of the new regulations.
Really, really scared. I mean, I collapsed. I felt I'd colluded. They emptied everything that they'd transferred from Santander and everything that was in my Tide account. These scams have become so sophisticated. The right number, knowing details of my account. I'm a specialist in financial markets and corruption, and they managed to fool me. The instant refund is going to make all the difference. People can rest assured in using online banking. The fact that electronic money institutions now have to adhere to this and that it needs to be refunded within 5 days really protects the ordinary people.
Now, the BBC's cost of living correspondent, Coletta Smith, is here to tell us more. Evening, Coletta.
Hi there, Holly.
So just as you were hearing from Carol there, these scams, they are becoming so sophisticated, so commonplace. And, you know, whenever they are duping people who are experts, let's say, like Carol, rules like this are really important. So tell us, what do these regulations mean? What exactly is going to change?
Yeah, well, it's some pretty big changes that will cover the vast amount of scams that take place. So actually, fraud is the most commonly experienced crime in the UK. Lots of your listeners will have been defrauded at some point. It's often somebody posing as somebody in authority. Maybe you've clicked on that parcel scam. I don't know if you got one of those texts. Mm-hmm. Oh, are you awaiting a parcel? Just put in your details here. Then you suddenly get a call from someone who says they're from your bank trying to stop a transaction. Oh, I see you've clicked on a link. It's not a verified one. Could you just confirm your security details with me? And so it goes on. Suddenly, the scammers are into your account and they've taken a whole load of money. It's a hugely growing crime in the UK and one that affects a lot of people and it effectively takes a lot of money from a lot of people. So a lot of people say the regulator has been slow to act on this one, but the change that they're introducing that's been confirmed today, that's coming in just 12 days' time, is pretty massive. So what they're saying is that banks, rather than just voluntarily refunding customers, those who've signed up to that voluntary code, all banks will now be forced to refund customers immediately, so that within 5 days, if you contact your bank, if you've been scammed, contact your bank, tell them what's happened, show them the evidence, explain what's happened, and within 5 days, you should be fully refunded. Now, as I was saying, a lot of banks do that already at the moment, but sometimes it takes a very long time. It's a lot of stress for the individual to go through that process, a lot of worry, especially if you've lost a lot of money. And some banks only give you some of the money back. They say, oh, we've managed to get 10,000 of your 30,000 or whatever. So people miss out in the long run. So this should mean that 99% of fraud victims get their money back pretty quickly. If the bank suspects that you're perhaps involved within that fraud, mm-hmm. that it's not as straightforward, they can push the button and pause the process. So they've got a month to investigate whether this really was a scam or not. So it might take some people longer to get their money back, but effectively most people will get the vast majority, if not all of their money back, that up to £85,000 within 5 days. So it's a big change and a big relief for customers.
Yeah, a lot of people, given how frequently this is happening, a lot of people will argue that, you know, this is, it's about time, basically. But the question then is it enough? So the refunds are going to be mandatory, but the limit is capped. Could that be problematic?
Well, it could be for some of those really big scams. So if someone's involved in an investment scam, say, then that may well be over that £85,000 limit. But the majority of those authorised payment scams where you as an individual hand over some money because you think you're doing the right thing, because you've been told to, the vast majority, as the regulator says, 99% of cases will be under that £85,000 limit. So most will fall within that. And of course, the point of all of this is actually to give banks a bit of a kick up the rear end to do a bit more to stop the fraud happening in the first place. So that's what the regulator is hoping will happen. Not only that more people will get money back quicker, but actually the banks now have a big financial incentive to make sure that those frauds don't happen in the first place.
Coletta Smith, the cost of living correspondent for the BBC. Thanks for your insight in that. Really interesting. I say such an important issue for so many people at the minute. It is just approaching 7:15. Another huge issue for people tonight will be the football, of course. And tonight, Five Live will be bringing you live commentary of Liverpool's EFL Cup third round tie against West Ham. Already in place at Anfield is tonight's Five Live summariser. It's the former Premier League midfielder, none other than Michael Brown. Good evening, Michael.
Evening, you well?
I am very well. I'm wondering how tonight is going to go. Of course, these two sides coming off a very different sort of a weekend. But then you've got to think, particularly for Liverpool, it's going to be a completely different side that we'll see tonight, surely.
Well, I think that's what we're guessing. I know you've been kind to me. The question's going to be, how are West Ham going to cope? Liverpool are expected to make changes. Confidence is different here in this stadium in regards to the change, the new manager, how he's coped, how he's took it on. We might see a couple of youngsters. We're just getting little inklings now regarding the team's about to drop. Lots of change for Liverpool, but for West Ham, the pressure is on. I'm sure that's what you're going to ask me, aren't you? About
yeah,
how
yeah,
it's mounting. Pretty
much all of that in a nutshell. We can just leave it there, really. Look, but you know, for Arne Slot, this is his first knockout game. It's a competition. He always got the impression that Jurgen Klopp rather enjoyed, and it is an opportunity for Slot to get some silverware. Let's face it.
Yeah, for certain, it's one of those that you can get out of the way, get your first silverware early on in the campaign. But listen, different test. I think it's an opportunity for players who are not getting as many minutes, and obviously when a new manager comes in, you want any chance or any opportunity to show him what you can go on and do. So adapting to a new style, adapting in different ways, so it's an opportunity, isn't it? Silverware's there, expect a decent crowd as always at Anfield, and it should be a really enjoyable one. But for West Ham, they're under a lot of pressure quite quickly. I don't think there should be. I think it's going to take time for the manager to settle in. What type of team can he field? If he doesn't put a strong one, there'll be criticism for that.
Well, obviously, I mean, it's been an awful start for Julian Lopetegui, really, and you can't shy away from that. He certainly can't.
No, you can never shy away from it. This is the results business. It's tough. The West Ham supporters demanded a change. They wanted to see a different style of football. They've backed him. They've spent money. But it will take time. I think everyone has to understand that. West Ham supporters, who will be critical, obviously, for the start that they've had, the position in the table, etc. It's difficult when you come in this game. The draw's not very kind to them, is it? You're looking over your shoulder to the weekend where you've got to get a result, but they've got to come here and show something.
Yeah, it's not the game they would have wanted after that weekend. Always great to chat to you, Michael Brown. Enjoy, just remember, live commentary of Liverpool versus West Ham here on 5 Live. It's an 8pm kickoff, of course, and we've got build-up with Steve Crossman from 7 o'clock, plus updates from the Emirates, where Arsenal host League One Bolton, as well as from Old Trafford, where Manchester United take on Dutch FC 20 in the Europa League. It's 47 minutes past six.
However bad it gets for the West Ham manager tonight, he's not going to find himself in the jaws of a hippo. Unlike Roland Cherry, here's his amazing story.
So we were in a two-man kayak, and the guide's in the lead kayak behind us, and there were three kayaks behind. And the guide in the lead kayak turned around to my wife, Shirley, who was in the front of our canoe, and said, hippos to the right will keep to the left. So we thought, no problem. We'll follow you and we'll go to the left, which we duly did. But about a minute later, probably no longer, there was an almighty crash, much like a car crash, really. And our canoe leapt up in the air. So back first. And we were turfed out into the water. And we kind of knew immediately what had happened. But in the kind of the impact, the side of the canoe smashed into my right shoulder and the shoulder was dislocated as we were turfed into the water. So we both arrived in the water. Shirley followed the instruction, which is swim like crazy for the bank. I was unable to swim because I only had one arm, really. So I was trying to do my best with the one-arm doggy paddle But I was a bit of a sitting duck, really, not making a great deal of progress. And then I felt this thing come from underneath me and grab me. And I kind of knew, and my heart sank, what was happening. And then I was dragged underwater by the hippo in its jaws and taken down to the bottom of the river. And I remember thinking quite vividly that this really isn't the way I wanted to go. You know, there were still many things I wanted to do in life, and being sort of killed by a hippo in a river was not high on that agenda. And it took me down to the bottom of the river, and then it let me go, because the next thing I remember is that my life vest, and I had a good life vest on, done up properly, was taking me back up to the surface. And it's funny what you do, but I started counting the seconds, and I got to sort of 8, 9 and 10. And then I got to the surface and took a gulp of air. But I remember thinking, that's actually quite deep, isn't it?
What did it feel like? Because not many people have done this and survived. So what did it feel like to be in the jaws of a hippo?
I was aware I was being dragged down. I wasn't aware of acute pain or anything, or any sort of awareness. I just had this sensation of being dragged down underwater. And I thought I was probably going to drown at that stage. But I had no great sensation of these enormous fangs digging into me. And I wonder whether part of this is my mind and the trauma and the way the body and the brain copes with extreme trauma, where it helps blank certain things out to try and protect you.
So you're back on the surface then. Again, what was going through your mind? What was your next move?
I was relieved to get to the surface, obviously, and took a huge gulp of air. But I'm afraid that wasn't the end of it. So this is all happening very fast, as you can imagine. The next thing that apparently happened, and I have no conscious memory of this, is that the hippo came and grabbed me in its jaws, reared out of the water, and then threw me like a rag doll, apparently 2 meters in the air, but towards the bank, which is what saved my bacon, really. Had it thrown me back towards the middle of the river, I think that would have been curtains. But I have no conscious memory of that. The next conscious memory I have is sitting in fairly shallow water, looking down at my legs. My right thigh was a right mess. There was bits of flesh sticking out of my shorts, and there was lots of blood on my left leg where there was another puncture wound. And on my left arm, there was a bite through the bicep, we now know, but a huge gash, a 9-inch gash on my lower abdomen. But that was hidden by the life vest at the time. And I remember thinking, I've really got to stay with it and stay conscious. And then I heard Shirley, my wife, calling my name behind, and other friendly voices. And then friendly arms came out and reached me and dragged me back. And I remember thinking, I'm in real trouble here. This is not good. And then a little motorboat arrived from the camp, and I was bundled on board and then taken back to camp. We know that I was thrown through the air by a very graphic eyewitness account of a young Australian girl who was in 2 canoes back from us. And this was all happening in front of her. She rather had the box seats, and she graphically describes this hippo emerging from the water. And then she saw me lying prostrate in its jaws, looking very limp and lifeless. And she thought I was already dead. And indeed, the guide apparently called out saying, no, he's dead or something. And that's when she saw me being thrown like a rag doll. She said, I hesitate to use this analogy, but you've seen the footage of the great white sharks playing with the fur seals off Cape of Good Hope. Well, she said, well, that's what it was like. You were tossed through the air like a rag doll. But I wasn't conscious of that. So it does make me wonder whether I was kind of comatose at that stage in a kind of brain protection shutdown mode or something. I don't know.
Well, the fear, and I guess the delayed pain and everything. Now take us through how your life was saved then, because this is extraordinary as well.
Well, they got me back to the camp, which, to say, was only about 100 metres back upstream in this little motorboat. And I was then unloaded and put across 3 seats in a minibus that belonged to the camp. And then they drove me the sort of 30, 35 minutes to the local town of Chirindu in Zambia. So that's right on the Zambezi. It's a border town, but on the Zambian side. They'd arranged, apparently, to meet the air ambulance company there, who were going to take me across the river into Zimbabwe, because that's where they were based. But there was no sign of them when we got to Chirindu. So the driver, I think it was, of the minibus said, and this is a key decision, as it turned out, said, they're not here. We must take him to the hospital. And the Entembe Mission Hospital was just a kilometre up the road in Chirindu. And they took me there. And I have some fairly vague memories of happening. And my wife, Shirley, was sort of doing all the sort of the organizing at this stage. But they took me in and they said, Mr. Cherry, you're in a very bad way. We are going to operate on you now. So they didn't say, give us your credit card details, give us your insurance details. They just said, look, as a fellow citizen of this planet, you're in a very bad way and we need to sort you out. So they took me into the next room. I hesitate to call it a theater. And then they knocked me out and then they operated. So they opened up, cleaned all the wounds as best they could. And then they sewed them up in the fairly rough way, but enough for me to be transported. And that early intervention under that first general anesthetic proved to be key, because we were then moved across into Zimbabwe early that afternoon. But we were seeking authorization from the insurance company to have me air evacuated to Johannesburg. But that didn't come through till the following afternoon. So the accident was Tuesday morning. We're now talking early afternoon Tuesday, but it took till Wednesday early afternoon to get that authorization. And then the aircraft, I was then taken to an airstrip, and then the aircraft loaded me up and took me down to Johannesburg.
And I want to come back to that hospital, the first hospital you went to, because this is where the story becomes very uplifting. But just before that, just summarise for us what they said in Johannesburg about the extent of your injuries.
The immortal words of Dr. Venter, the plastic surgeon, later that afternoon when she came to see me, she said, Mr. Cherry, somebody upstairs doesn't think your time on this earth is over just yet. And I just stared at her and she said, well, put it this way. You weren't lucky once. You weren't lucky twice. You were lucky three times. She said, if any of those wounds in your right thigh, your left leg and your abdomen had been 4 or 5 mil deeper, you would have lost one or both of your legs. And if the wound had gone into your abdomen, into your gut, we probably couldn't have saved you. You probably have either bled to death or the infection would have taken hold and we probably couldn't control that.
And they did they not find teeth marks on your bones?
They found scrape marks on both tibias. Yeah, the my right thigh, there's a very graphic, and it's not for family viewing, but there is a very graphic photograph taken by Dr. Venter in that first operation in Johannesburg, where she's got an instrument that's gone inside my thigh, and it's about 6 or 7 inches long, something like that, and that disappears inside my thigh, but up my thigh, and there are tusk scuff marks on both tibia, on the tibia left and right.
It's fair to say we're very lucky to be talking to you today, without a shadow of a doubt. And ultimately, I'm coming back to that hospital and what you're doing. But I just now just reflect for me on what you went through. How the surgeon said somebody up above was looking down. How do you reflect on the fact you are here today talking to me?
She went on to say, you are a very lucky man, Mr. Cherry. You may not feel it right now, but I do feel enormously fortunate. I mean, you only have to Google hippo attacks on the internet, and it's including the BBC website, and it's full of gruesome stories of people much less fortunate than me. So I was enormously fortunate on two regards. One is the extent of my injuries, although gruesome to look at, there was no vital organ damage and no broken bones. But as Dr. Venter said, literally a millimeter either side, you know, where those scuff marks were, would have snapped your legs off. You'd be gone. So I'm very fortunate that the injuries weren't worse. And I'm also very fortunate with that very early intervention at the Zambian hospital.
You've talked about your fortune. Let's talk about the gratitude you feel then to that first hospital now, because you're raising money for them, aren't you? What are you planning? What are you hoping? What are you doing?
Well, we've got a Just Giving page, Just Giving Roland Cherry / Roland Cherry. You can find that. And people have been enormously generous so far. But we, you know, what I've termed the kindness of strangers, these people didn't demand money. They saw a fellow citizen in great trouble and just got on and sorted me out. They sewed me up and sent me off to the more advanced care that I got in South Africa. But that early intervention, you know, they gave me everything that they had. And I feel I need to repay. You can't just take in life. You have to give back. And I feel enormously passionate that anything that I can do and raise money to help them buy equipment, what they urgently need and what they need perhaps more than anything is a 4x4 ambulance. At the moment, this is a little mission hospital that has no ambulance. So they can't move. They can't collect patients. They can't move them around. That would be a vehicle that would be used 4 or 5 times a day, I guess. enormous help in the community. So although we've got a £10,000 target on the Just Giving page at the moment, I'm hoping that with the media coverage that we're getting about the story, we can blow that to smithereens with the kindness of people here in the UK. And if we can, you know, if people can give, you know, just a few pounds, it makes a massive difference if lots of people do it.
Yeah, well, just repeat the name of the page for us then, people. If they've
well, it's Just Giving and / Roland Cherry, Cherry, same as the fruit, then they'll find me.
Roland, real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks
nice
a lot.
To speak to you.
Cheers.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Because we played that earlier, we already know that you guys have been very, very generous to Roland and his Just Giving page. So thank you very much on Roland's behalf for that. Andy says, Drive amuses me, informs me, educates me, and sometimes I feel sad or happy or angry listening to the show. The hippo story, absolutely astounded me. Fantastic.
So. I know you all enjoyed the toad story as well. Hippos and toads. Where else would you get it, sure?
Well, tomorrow here from 4
yep,
o'clock.
Yep, exactly.
We'll see you then. We'll see you then.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. This is Nick Qureshi. Israeli troops have been told to prepare for a possible ground offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. The chief of the defence staff said Hezbollah would come up against a professional, highly skilled and battle-experienced force. Airstrikes by Israel have today killed 51 people in Lebanon and injured more than 220 others. Hezbollah, which is proscribed as a terrorist organisation by the UK, fired a ballistic missile at Tel Aviv. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, says any Israeli ground offensive could last some time.
Hopes that it might be a quick in and out, some kind of glorified raid, I think, are unlikely. The way it's been looking, I think the Israelis want to do some damage to Hezbollah facilities there. But the minute they get over that border, Hezbollah will want to do some damage to them.
A police officer who stole cocaine from an evidence store at work has been found guilty of misconduct. Liverpool Crown Court heard Andrew Talbot supplied the drugs between February 2018 and January 2020 in Manchester. The 54-year-old will be sentenced next month. Members of the RMT union have accepted pay offers from train companies and Network Rail. The union said ballot results meant its long-running dispute was over. The Prime Minister has insisted motions at the Labour Party conference do not dictate government policy after members voted in favour of reversing cuts to winter fuel payments for pensioners in England and Wales. The motion at the event in Liverpool is non-binding. The former Cabinet Minister, Michael Gove, is to become the new editor of The Spectator. The appointment is subject to approval from the Independent Advisory Committee on Business Appointments. It's our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
Michael Gove, who stepped down from Parliament at the general election, was a journalist before he became a Conservative MP. He takes on his new role as editor of the right-leaning Spectator as the Conservative Party prepares to elect its next leader. Mr Gove replaces the former editor, Fraser Nelson, who has been in the role for 15 years. Mr Nelson will continue to write for The Spectator and will become associate editor. Earlier this month, it was announced that The Spectator had been sold for £100 million to the hedge fund tycoon Sir Paul Marshall.